This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Anita Rani, and welcome to Woman's Hour from BBC Radio 4. Good morning. Welcome to Friday's Woman's Hour. Today's show comes with a warning. We are reclaiming sexist language later. If you want a clue to the word, what word comes before please and after basic, boss, and of course, Britney? Quick quiz to get you thinking. If you have got children at home, I will give you plenty of warning before that item. And a year on from when the world witnessed the horrific murder of George Floyd, I'm going to be joined by Ghislaine Kinuani and Emma DeBerry to talk about overcoming black trauma, how the experience of being born black in the West can affect every aspect of your life and your psychology, and what can be done about it. It will be a really interesting and important conversation. Then, as it's Friday, I have a musical treat for your ears.
Bahome pade jhoole.
Absolutely divine. The sounds of singer, songwriter, musician Aruj Aftab. She's my latest musical obsession, and I can't wait to speak to her live from her home in Brooklyn. And of course, we want to hear your thoughts throughout the programme about anything you hear. You can text us. It's Woman's Hour, is 84844. The text will be charged at your standard message rate, so do check with your network provider for exact costs. And you can contact us via social media. It's at BBC Woman's Hour, or you can email us through your website. Now, the dust has settled on the recent court ruling on compensation for women with PIP implants. It's become clear a group of women will miss out. The court in France ruled that those who had implants before September 2006 won't get any money, as it decided the safety regulator who approved the implants for market couldn't have been aware of any problems before that date. Lawyers representing the women will go back to the French Supreme Court to fight this. Well, Melanie Abbott has been looking into this for us and joins us now. Melanie, it was widely reported on our programme and others that the compensation claim was successful. What's happened?
Absolutely, yeah. And for some, it certainly was successful. But as always, the cliche goes, the devil is in the small print. Now, you will remember that PIP implants were filled with industrial grade silicon instead of medical silicon. And this made them 6 times more likely to rupture. The case was a huge scandal. The head of PIP, Jean-Claude Mass, was sentenced to prison for 4 years for fraud. He did die there. The company went bankrupt. For years now, lawyers have been pursuing the company who approved the implants for market, providing the safety certificates for them. And that's a German company called Two Rhineland. 2 weeks ago, it was announced that compensation had been granted to the women affected. But once the full 288-page judgment was read in detail, it became clear that it wasn't that straightforward. I've been talking to Nicola Mason, one of the women affected. She had her implants in 2004. She has received 3,000 euros in an interim compensation payment, but she has spent £8,500 having her implants replaced.
It's just really shocking, isn't it? Because you're putting a price on someone's life and not on someone else's. I mean, I fall into the second category, and yet I had such a bad rupture. My implants had to be left out for a whole year to heal. and I'm still left with a golf ball size lump of silicon under my right arm. So quite how someone, just because theirs was done some 18 months later, would get paid, but I wouldn't. And yet, who knows what my long-term health consequences of that will be. It's a shocker, but then the whole thing's a shocker, isn't it? But to be honest with you, I don't have faith that anyone will ever get paid out anyway. It's been going on such a long time. I just think they'll keep on appealing. It's probably going to go on another however many years, isn't it? Obviously, the guy who was totally responsible died in prison. So they've gone after someone else who will fight it and fight it because they obviously don't think it's their problem.
It must be very alarming when the silicon is swelling up under your arm.
Yeah, and it happens. I mean, it's at least on a monthly basis.
That so often, really?
Yeah, I guess if my glands come up for any reason, as you know, if you know, feel a little bit under the weather or there's anything going around, and it will come up, and it will just for a day or so, but it makes you very aware every single day that it's still there. And I think that's the biggest thing, really. It's not the pain from it, because it's not agony. It's uncomfortable. It's the awareness that actually that's still left in my body, and that panics me a little bit.
It's the reminder.
It's the reminder. And my worry has always been, and it's the worry about going back in to take it out, because the surgeon that reconstructed mine did say at a later date, he may be able to go back in and take it out. My worry is, how many times should you allow yourself to be opened up in that same place?
All these years on, then, you still face further surgery because of the pick.
Because of that. Absolutely. And that's why I say I massively regret it. But what can you do? Hindsight.
What does it do to your emotions when you hear the different bits of news trickling out about it?
I guess 11 days ago when it first came out, I thought, oh, absolutely, finally. Not even really for the money. It's been such a long time now. And obviously I paid for mine to be repaired 8 years ago. It's paid, it's done. So it's not even really about the money. It's about one human deciding it's okay to basically poison another human. Most of the time I try not to think about the implants, even though I've got it under my arm and it swells my glands up, because I have a 9-year-old son, and a decision I made when I was 29, it worries me for my future.
Is it a decision that you regret now?
Massively, absolutely massively. And don't get me wrong, I'm not anti-surgery at all. Maybe if I had been advised properly by the company I went to, because he should have told me to wait until I'd had children. And had I have waited, I still would have had an operation, but I wouldn't have had implants put in. I would have had an uplift and a reduction. I had the tissue there to do it. But by the time they'd ruptured and they had to take so much of it away, along with all the silicone that was wrapped around it, I was then no longer left with enough to do that and had to have the implants put back in. The guy who repaired them, Mr. Makarantare, he was an amazing man, a lovely surgeon, and literally has done his absolute best. And he said to me, he never used those PIP implants, even when he had the chance, because they were so cheap. I went to a large, reputable London company. They made that decision as well to use a very cheap product whilst charging a premium price. It's around about £6,500. I literally, when I heard the news when it first happened, I thought, I won't have those. I've been to a top company. I pay top prices.
When you say you don't think you'll see any of the compensation,
yeah,
why do you think that is?
Because I just think they'll fight it to the very end. And I think in the end, you'll just end. I just cannot imagine that they can, that the amount of people also that are affected by it, I think it probably even send them bankrupt. I just can't see it ever happening. And if they do have to pay out, it will probably be such a minuscule amount.
You sound almost resigned to that rather than angry or devastated.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not that I need the money. It's the principle, isn't it? And yes, we made the decision to have the surgery. And, you know, you have a little battle in your head sometimes and think, well, it's partly my fault because I did that for cosmetic reasons. You know, I didn't have cancer. I didn't have to have it done. So you have this little private battle and you think, I shouldn't have had it. And I wouldn't have had it if I was a mum. I would have made such different decisions. So there is that private battle, and it isn't. But they have allowed poison these people. It does make me wonder who signed that off, who actually thought, oh, well, it doesn't matter. But it does matter because it's people's lives.
It must take quite a lot of energy to keep following it. Do you sometimes just think, oh, I wish it would all go away?
Absolutely. It comes around. It's almost like sometimes you forget and an email comes through and you think, oh, yeah, I'm still fighting that. And I think for me, that's how I deal with it, because it's best to put it almost out of mind rather than literally worry about it every single day. If there are girls out there wanting to have the operation done, just really do your homework, find out what you're having. Find out if you have to have them replaced again, and really look into your surgeon and the company. Really think about it. And I would say that I would always wait until you've had children to have it done, because you change as a person and your decisions will be different.
That's Melanie speaking to Nicola Mason. Shocking and heartbreaking listening to that. Melanie, what do the lawyers have to say about it all?
Yeah, I've spoken to the lawyers in France who have been leading on this action. And I have to say, they told me that they are pretty mystified about this ruling, about this 2006 date. They say they've got no idea where it really comes from. Olivier Omeitre is one of those leading the legal action.
Actually, everybody was very surprised by this decision, and no one understood what's happened for the very good reason, which is the following one. No one asked such a limitation. In a word, the Court of Appeal of Paris ruled on a point which was not in the discussion, which was not in the case. We are going to file an appeal against this decision before the Supreme Court. And I have no doubt, for the reason I explained, that the Supreme Court is going to overturn the decision.
Okay, so he thinks they're going to overturn the decision, but it does mean they have to appeal. How long is that going to take?
Yeah, it's all going to take a long time. I mean, you heard the frustration from Nicola Mason there. This could take another 2 years. Olivier Omeitre told me that he thinks the court chose 2006 as the date because the court didn't believe that TÜV Rheinland, that's the company being sued for negligence, could be expected to have any concerns before then about what was happening at the factory making PIP implants. If they did have concerns, then they should have been making unannounced checks, which they never did. PIP employees were actually removing any evidence of the industrial silicone gel before TÜV Rheinland went to make their annual inspections. Olivier said previous hearings, though, have ruled that there were problems since 2001. And he says he believes it was obvious that PIP didn't have enough medical grade gel to fill all of the implants it was producing.
Goodness me. And there have been other hurdles along the way, haven't there?
Yeah, there have. I mean, this case is so complicated. As well as those women like Nicola, another 6,000 women, and many of them, in fact, I'm told most of them are from the UK, they had their cases ruled inadmissible back in February. And this was because the courts then ruled that there wasn't the evidence that they actually had been fitted with PIP implants. And it seems to boil down to a card which comes in the box with the implant, and that wasn't provided to the courts to prove what kind of implant they had.
Women have been declared admissible because, according to the court, they didn't bring the evidence they had PIP implants, but the court made a mistake, you know? And it's very easy to bring this evidence because in many countries, the PIP implants were sold through distributors. And I know these distributors because they are also my clients. It is wrongly that the court reject a claim from women due to the fact that all PIP implants were fulfilled with industrial silicone gel.
Gosh, it's a minefield. But Melanie, you're talking us through it very clearly. There seems to be a lot of hearings taking place.
Yeah, it really is, as you say, a minefield. In fact, there are four separate court actions going on, though two of those have been joined together. Olivier Omeitre, he tells me that this is because in France, there's no such thing as a class action where everyone can bring a case as one group, so that when more women come forward, they can't be tagged onto existing legal action. They have to start new cases. And in fact, they're about to start a fifth case.
And what does the company TV to Rheinland say about this?
Yeah, referring to the cutoff date of September 2006, TÜV said that the evidence clearly shows that TÜV Rheinland acted diligently in compliance with acceptable regulations and that it wasn't its role to track down the fraud. It added that at no time was there anything to suggest breast implants manufactured by PIP weren't compliant. And it also pointed out that the European Court of Justice ruled back in 2017 that companies like TÜV aren't under any general obligation to pay unannounced visits or indeed to examine products or the manufacturer's business records. And they also pointed out that in the criminal proceedings, Tuve was found to be a victim of the fraud too. As soon as that fraud was discovered, which was back in March 2010 now, Tuve suspended the safety certificates which it had granted to PIP.
Gosh, Melanie, thank you very much for all of that. Well, we can talk now to Jan Spivey, who runs the PIP campaign based in the UK that has sought accountability for the hundreds of thousands of women globally who've been affected by these implants. 20 years ago, she was given PIP implants after she had a mastectomy due to breast cancer. She developed sore and aching joints, chest and back pain, fatigue, severe headaches and anxiety. Once removed, it was clear her implants had been leaking silicone into her body. Well, Jan was on this programme just 2 weeks ago when she first heard they would be entitled to compensation. And this is the reaction she gave Emma.
Absolutely elated. It's just tremendous news. We're a little bit in shock, to be completely frank with you. It's been such an exhausting battle to get this far, and we've had to battle it out in France.
And Jan is back on the programme now. Jan, what a difference 2 weeks can make. How are you feeling today? Jan? Nope, we will try and come back.
Oh, I'm yes, here,
you
are.
Yes, there we go. Was it classic Zoom mute moment? There we go. Yeah, so we just heard you there, elated, drinking champagne just 2 weeks ago. 2 weeks
yes,
later, how are you feeling?
Very early in the morning that day. We were preparing for the decision on the morning of the 20th, and we had been told by our lawyers that the decision would be a long document and that they would skip initially to the end to find out what the main decision would be. And what we wanted most from the day was a decision from the French courts that TUV Rhineland had been found guilty of failures in the regulation of PIP. And that was the great news. After 10 years of battling, the French courts had confirmed that TUV Rhineland had been guilty of failures in regulating PIP implants.
How do you feel? How do you feel about the news that we're hearing today? Have you read the 288-page report?
Well, I haven't, but by 10:30 p.m. That same day, I knew that the lawyers would be going through the whole of the document to check the details, and that's when we learned that there would be some women that had been ruled inadmissible by the courts.
Yeah, if you had your surgery before 2006.
It turns out that's just one of the possible reasons that the court has given to rule women inadmissible.
Or if you don't have the card that states that what the implants you had were PIP, but who keeps a card from, over 20 years ago?
Well, it's not always a card, and that's important because what the appeal court in Aix-en-Provence stated was that women needed to have a set of abbreviations linked to their serial numbers on their PIP. But those words were in French, and we don't, in the UK, we're not dealing with implants that are given French names. A breast implant in the UK is referred to as a breast implant, not as an implant mammaire, which is what is referred to in France.
What's your situation now?
Well, it's really important to say that the decision in the Paris Appeal Court on Thursday, 20th of May, is really meaningful for all of us affected. It's a really huge global achievement. And TUV Rhineland is a private company and it has duties for public safety. And they have claimed from the beginning that they were also PIP victims and that PIP was a complex fraud. But our case was based on the knowledge that TUV Rhineland failed to do its job properly and take its duties for safety seriously. And that's what we've managed to achieve in the courts this month.
Although we just heard from Nicola there, who says she has no faith in seeing any compensation now.
Yes, and unfortunately for lots of women like Nicola, they also feel the same way. But it's really important to understand that the way that the compensation is decided is by an independent court expert who will assess the injuries and the implications for each woman involved. And we expect that to be a fair and reasonable amount, and we expect it to be substantial. What the remaining women, the women that have been excluded from the case, we will have to struggle through yet another appeal, but struggle through another appeal we will. The point that the courts have arrived at is that TUV have failed in assessing the real safety implications for PIP from 2006 onwards, but we know that those failures started much earlier.
So you haven't lost your spirit to keep fighting, Jem?
Oh, absolutely not. And that's really my message today, that women that feel disheartened by the decisions from both appeal courts should really be encouraged not to give up, because this is not the end. It is unfortunate that TUV Rhineland are still denying the responsibilities for their failures. But, you know, the evidence is clear. They have been found guilty of failures, and it will be another long process, but we will get there in the end.
So what's keeping you going? Because the emotional and physical impact of the fighting for you, Jan, all these years, and the ups and downs must be huge.
Yeah, they really are. But, you know, when it comes to an issue of justice, you know, if a company is not doing its job properly and hundreds of thousands of women have been negatively impacted, we're all still suffering from the effects of toxic chemicals in our bodies. And that's what keeps me and so many others going, that, you know, this isn't right. It isn't fair. And all those responsible, including the manufacturer, but also the company that issues the licenses, that regulates implants, have to be held accountable.
Jan, thank you very much for speaking to us. I'm sure we'll be talking to you again before all of this is over. And we just had an email in. By the way, if you do want to contact us about anything you hear in the programme, you can text 84844 or email by going to our website. I'm now 64, had implants in my 20s, many years after, following many health problems, one breast hardening of the implants, many consultations with plastic surgeons who would not agree with problems with the implants. It was proven there was a problem with the implants, and all the women to be compensated after a couple of years with solicitors. We got a payout of £30 each. I had all the health problems you've mentioned this morning. I had implants removed. All my health problems disappeared. Goodness me. Like I say, you can email us by going to our website, or you can contact us via our social media. It's at BBC Woman's Hour. Now, last week was the first anniversary of George Floyd's murder, an event so shocking and traumatic, it changed the world. Since then, there's been huge amounts of anger and protests and conversations happening amongst friends, and so many hashtags on social media. And thoughtful and powerful books have also been written, including by my next two guests. Academic and broadcaster Emma Dabiri decided to write What White People Can Do Next, a manifesto for change, which looks at the invention of racism and calls for a move towards coalition in order to dismantle racism. Therapist and researcher Ghislaine Kinuani's book, Living While Black, looks at black trauma. It focuses on the damage caused by racial trauma and how it contributes to psychological distress and how black people respond to it. So how does trauma affect black people, and where are we currently with the conversation around anti-racism? Well, I'm delighted Emma and Ghislaine join me to discuss this further now. Welcome to Woman's Hour, both of you. I'm going to start by asking you both why you wanted to write your books. Let's come to you first, Ghislaine.
Hi, Anita. Well, various reasons that have led me to Living While Black. I would say, number one, a sense of dissatisfaction when it comes to mainstream mental health services, ability to deal with white supremacy and race-related distress. And it was, of course, also my own lived experience and the experience that I have acquired clinically through people coming to see me in distress, in pain, quite troubled by experiences of race discrimination. And finally, there was a huge need following the murder of George Floyd and the increase in psychological distress, in anxiety, in racial trauma, and people coming to me over and over again with their race-based distress. So overall, those three reasons led to me writing Living While Black.
And how about you, Emma? Quite a provocative title, What White People Can Do Next.
Yes, it is provocative. First of all, lovely to be here and excited to be meeting Ghislaine.
Have you not met before?
We've not met.
I love that Women's Hour is facilitating this meeting of minds. Fantastic.
Yeah, I think there are some similarities there. A lot of my motivation in writing this book, What White People Can Do Next, with the arguably controversial title, which I can return to, was a sense of dissatisfaction as well in many ways with a lot of the liberal mainstream framing of the anti-racist narrative, especially a lot of the discourse that was finding its origins online and on social media, much of which is reductive. And while it takes it evokes the names of past Black intellectuals and activists and organizers, but it often is untethered from the radical and expansive environments in which that work was created. So I was trying to provide more historical context, I think, to what a lot of the discourse that we see on social media, to just kind of broaden that out so that we could maybe reframe some of the conversation and reconfigure our aims. A lot of the movements of the past have a consistent set of demands, which I feel is somewhat missing in the current moment.
Okay, well, we'll come back to that. Let's go back to you, Ghislaine. You're a therapist, you're a psychologist, and you work with people of colour. What's your experience been?
My experience has been that the harm of racism psychologically and physically is hugely underestimated. My experience has been that when people experience everyday trauma, which might sometimes look like subtle acts or more micro experiences, they can be easily discounted so that people come to themselves, doubt their experience, gaslight themselves, which increase their distress, but also has the impact of them not seeking help, not seeking support for what they are going through. Now, my position is very clear. The empirical evidence is solid. At this point in time, we can no longer put our hand in the sand and pretend that racism doesn't do psychological and physical harm. So the question is this: why are Black people, and indeed people of color, not being supported adequately with those experiences? That is a question.
Well, we did have a commission on race and ethnic disparities, as I'm sure you're both aware, and the chair of that, Tony Sewell, and he says, this quote, put it simply, we no longer see a Britain where the system is deliberately rigged against ethnic minorities. Where do you go with that, Ghislaine, based on what you're saying? You're saying that,
well,
you know,
we what I would accept. Say to the what I would say to the commission is that I'm afraid it is not within the commission's gift to ignore the scientific evidence around the harm and the prevalence of structural racism. That this is not something that anyone has the power to do. What we can do as a society is decide to face the issue or pretend that there are no issues. And it appears that the commission have chosen the latter.
Okay, Ghislaine, well, let's just explain to everyone listening then, let's talk about racial trauma, because there may be people who genuinely do not understand what it is and how it affects people, Black people, people of colour. Break it down to us. And if you can, I know it's a huge subject, but let's go for it. How does it affect people in health, I guess, education, justice, professional environment? It's so ingrained and deep-rooted. But, you know, give us some examples of what the experiences of people are that are coming to speak to you.
Okay, so when we're talking about racial trauma, fundamentally, what we are talking about is the trauma consequences, or perhaps we could say more broadly, the psychological impact of being exposed to racism. That is what we are talking about, the distress that is occasioned by racism. How does that look like on our psychologies, on how we navigate the world? Well, we're talking about groups of people having difficulties with their self-esteem, their confidence, because the message constantly that they are hearing and that therefore they are internalizing is that you are not good enough, you're not as good, you are less than, you are inferior. Eventually, these messages make this way through our psychology. So that is one area. Another area might be in relation to, for example, safety, safeness, anxiety in the world when you enter a particular space and you are fearful that you might be treated unfairly, or you are fearful that you are going to experience discrimination. So that can raise level of stress, level of anxiety. Generally, when we are thinking about a parent-child, so perhaps a bit more intergenerationally, we need to ask ourselves, what does it mean for family functioning to have a parent, to have a mother preoccupied by her own experience of racism if she is facing, let's say, racial harassment, racial bullying, racial discrimination in the workplace? That is obviously going to have an impact on how we mother, and the attention and the availability that we have for our own children. So therefore, our capacity to be good enough parents might be compromised. That is another area. Then what do we do as communities as a whole, right? When we are trying as a group to survive racism, some of the stories, some of the strategies that we implement, such as let's try to work really, really hard as possible, 3 times, 4 times, 5 times, 7 times harder to try to overcompensate and overcome those structural blockers. That has an impact on our health, that also have an impact on our relationship. And I could go on and on and on, but essentially the message that I want to leave the listener is that racism harms, and it harms everyone. And that harm has a cost socially, and it has a cost for the NHS as well.
Emma, Ghislaine brought up strategies there. There've been so many strategies put into workplaces to try and deal with this, haven't there?
Yes, there have been. There's a whole diversity and inclusion, emphasis
have
at
they,
the moment.
Have they worked? Are they working?
Well, I think that remains to be seen. You know, a lot of the kind of reinvestment in diversity and inclusion has come off the back of the murder of George Floyd last year and subsequent developments. You know, I think to date, no diversity and inclusion has not worked, but there is a kind of renewed interest in it. However, renewed investment in it, let me say. And I do see, I do go and speak to a lot of companies, a lot of institutions that do appear to be, you know, truly committed to these things. However, I think thus far, I think with diversity and inclusion, what we have to keep in mind is that alone is not a panacea for racism. You know, these systems, these ideas, these racialized categories are deeply entrenched, have had centuries to really embed. People are deeply invested in kind of whiteness and racialized identity. So it will take more than corporate diversity and inclusion programs to overcome everything that needs to be done. One of the things that my latest book has focused on is actually thinking about whiteness as well, you know, because whiteness, and not so much whiteness just as a in terms of people who are racialized as white, but whiteness actually as a knowledge system, going back into the origins of whiteness in the 17th century and the way in which the idea of a white race was invented for a very specific purpose and with very specific objectives. It's at the kind of origins, in the book I make the argument that race and capitalism are siblings. The invention of the idea of a white race occurs at the same time as the system of capitalism is being designed that we live under today. Central to the construction of the idea of the white race, you know, from the 17th century, is an idea of the inherent superiority of people who are racialized as white, and subsequently the idea of an inherent inferiority of people who become racialized as black. That was central to the construction of those racial categories that emerged during the transatlantic slave trade in order to justify the enslavement and exploitation of people who come to be racialized as black. When we are armed with that information, we can kind of stop that. I think there's a very disingenuous conversation that often happens about racism, and we get these situations whereby, you know, something racist happens and it's being discussed, and then the debate is framed as though one side is saying this is racist, you know, and the other side is saying, no, it's not. And they're horrified and shocked and appalled that even the merest suggestion of racism could be occurring. And this faux horror, and we don't often get past that quite confrontational and combative framework. If we go back to the origins of the invention of race, and we see that whiteness was created, the idea of a white race was created in order to enshrine and it originally was codified into law, this idea of a superiority of white people, we see that from its earliest origins, there's been this hierarchy in the racialized order. And in fact, the racialized order was created to create racism. Then we know that we have to tackle the idea of race, which is something that is far greater and deeper than just corporate diversity and inclusion programs. So that work can be done, but something broader and deeper needs to happen as well. And that's what White People Can Do Next sets out a framework where that other work can happen.
Well, you have both written important and in-depth books looking at this from two very different angles. And this is a conversation that I know we will come back to. Sadly, we haven't got the time to give it the amount of time it needs properly this morning. But Ghislaine Kinuani and Emma Dabiri, thank you so much for speaking to me. Their books are out now, Living While Black, The Essential Guide to Overcoming Racial Trauma and What White People Can Do Next. Now, language and the way we use it is forever changing. And today we're going to be exploring how some words which have a sexist history are being reinvented. I should warn you that some of the language in this next discussion, some listeners may find offensive. And if you have young children around, it's best to maybe come back to us later. Now, the word bitch is something we hear in film, on our TVs and in music, from Cardi B to Britney Spears to RuPaul's Drag Race. What makes someone a bitch? And can it ever truly be reclaimed to mean something positive? Well, to discuss this further, I'm joined by Shantae Joseph, a social media creative and writer, Jacqueline Springer, a black music and culture journalist, and Helen Taylor is an emeritus professor of English at the University of Exeter. Shantae, how often do you use the word, and can it be something positive?
I would say that I do use it quite often. And yes, it can be something that is positive, but also, yeah, of course, it can be something that is negative. But I definitely feel like when I use the word, like, do you know what I mean? It depends on the moment, because it's like you hear something shocking and you're like, bitch, or you know, someone's rude to you and you're like, that bitch. Do you know what I mean? Like, it very much depends on the context in which you are using that word. And I think with most words, sometimes things can come across as you're trying to insult someone, you're trying to offend someone, but then sometimes it's just the way you express yourself or the way you color your language that kind of gives it personality and tells the world who you are, sort of thing.
But for you, not offensive, you've reclaimed it. And you use it.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know if I said reclaim the word. I think I just use the word differently. Well, do you know what I mean? Like, I don't want to give it that much power that I feel like it's something that I need to claim, but it's just something that kind of I use to express myself.
Jacqueline, what impact do you think music has had on the word? Because, of course, you know, hip hop culture, the word is used a lot, not often very positively, though. I have to say, in a lot of hip hop, it's used quite negatively. But do you think that's been important in taking the power away from the word bitch?
I think the mainstream tend to have a very selective relationship with rap music, and they utilize rap as the whipping boy, for want of a different racialized context, when they want to discuss the influence it has on their children. When Queen Latifah in the 1990s had a song called Unity, and she's one of the first words that comes out of her mouth, one of the first phrases, she goes, "Who's you calling a bitch?" And she also talks about not only men using it, but women using it, to ingratiate themselves within male favor, but also the use of the word within the kind of traditional way we've been socialized, which is to put women down, to compare them to female canines, to also utilize it as a backdoor insult. So it's prefixed by fat, black, ugly, this, you know. So the whole point about this word is that it's malleable. The whole point about language is it's malleable. And the very idea that rap only uses it in one context is simplistic and self-serving. And you have men and women using it. And when Beyonce uses it, oh my God, how dare she does this? My kids love her songs. When Britney does it, it's affirmative and it's empowering. So we also have to, within the use of this word within music, to think about who the mainstream, i.e. the white majority in this country and around the world, tend to, who they feel has the right to influence their children by the use of a word that is as malleable as any other.
Yeah, so whose mouth is it coming out of? Helen, how does the way we use language change? And why do you think it's important to document this?
Well, it's interesting that the Oxford English Dictionary has started to look at the ways in which words that define woman are often negative, whereas words defining man are positive. And bitch is quite an interesting example of this, because it's a very old word. It comes from Old English, and it did indeed denote a female animal, female dog. And apparently the sort of, when a dog is on heat, suggested a way of talking about a woman. So a woman could be, so a bitch could be a lewd woman. And of course we know lewdness in women is bad. And Shakespeare used it slightly negatively to suggest a lewd or lascivious woman, and Dr. Johnson did too. But I think that what our two other speakers have been saying is that it's language is, as one of you said, it's malleable. It changes all the time, and bitch can be has been appropriated, obviously in rap and in feminist discourse. So women call themselves bitches as a term of powerfulness. It's a way of kind of throwing back at patriarchy, the fact that yes, I will call myself a bitch, and that suggests that I am empowered. And there's a wonderful line in Shirley Conran's Lace, where the pawn queen Lily turns to three women who she's not sure which is her mother, and she says, "Which one of you bitches is my mother?" And so, and the word bitch has also been used about homosexual men, actually, and it's been used very positively too. So people talk about, well, people talk about life's a bitch, which is sort of it's a kind of ambiguous way of talking about life. But people also talk about books are bitches, which is a way of saying books are great. So I think that the way in which language changes over time is a sign of its liveliness. And certainly feminists, if I could just finish a point, that feminists have use language so creatively over years. You know, they've coined terms like sexism, they've coined terms like glass cliff, toxic masculinity, me too, coercive control, gaslighting. The trans community uses the word woman with an X instead of an A. And I think that feminists have been actually in all sorts of ways more creative than any other group in finding ways of transforming the language. Alice Walker talked about womanism as a way of saying to white feminists, no, you know, I'm going to use a word that defines black feminism. And so language is always being kind of creatively used. And I do think feminists have been fantastic in shaping so new meaning.
Helen, what examples of other words can you give us that have had a sexist history that have been reclaimed or reused, or now we just use and don't think about as being offensive?
One word is virago. If you think of the way in which virago was used, virago was always used about a horrible kind of a nasty woman, nagging wife, all those sort of things. And when virago, excuse me.
Have a sip of water.
When, the publishing house, Virago, decided to call themselves Virago, they were saying, yes, we are angry, we are nasty, you know, we're not necessarily nice and gentle women. We are powerful and we're strong, and we reserve the right to be horrible too. And the word virago has, I think, because of that publishing house, it's become now a very strong word, very positive word.
Well, we've got some messages coming in. An email from Karim who says, bitch is positive and means someone who is willing to challenge in an assertive way unless it's used in a demeaning way. Helen, how much does it matter who's saying it?
I think you're absolutely right that it's who is saying it, the context in which it's said. If I called you a bitch, it would be extremely offensive. If I call my best friend a bitch, that's a way in which, as Shante said, you know, that's a way of reclaiming a word for yourself.
Jacqueline, how much does it matter who's saying it?
It matters. All language, everything is derived, all meaning is derived upon context. But I also think that there needs to be, are we actually reclaiming it, or, as Helen said, appropriating it? Because did women invent this word? Were they in positions of, you know, disseminatory power about what words mean? Who, you know, Samuel Johnson, a man, was given, you know, had the task of creating a dictionary upon which meaning and language is utilized. So are we actually reclaiming this word, or is it a case of with those who choose to use it beyond the context of its defined meaning are actually disrupting the very ways in which we think about it? So when we emasculate men, you know, we say, oh, don't be a bitch, stop crying like a bitch, man up. We gendered language so very much. And I think it's really telling that we have this segment after the first two of today's programme, because we're talking about the way in which women can be controlled via language, via the perception of their bodies. You know, you had the women in relation to the pip scare defending their own choices about what they did with their body. Mm. It's their body. So if women have been told, are told, you're a bitch, you're silly, you're this, you're that, and that they use that very word beyond the context of the accepted passage against you, against the gender, it starts to really make people very uncomfortable. You then add that to the discourse of music, where, oh, we shouldn't have a musical form, i.e. rap, that you know, embraces profanity, and we certainly shouldn't have women calling themselves a bitch. But you also have, you had rappers in the 90s like Lil' Kim, who adhere to, you know, respectability politics, to, you know, broadcast regulation, so she would call herself Queen Bee. You have music that is actually explicit or not. You can't control people's access to language. You can't control your children, after a certain time, their access to language. What you've really got to think about here is what is offensive, how you can, and how and why you've actually come to define that as offensive, and who you think has the right to entertain your children, and to what language they can use it. Because how is it empowering if Britney says, it's Britney, bitch, but if Lil' Kim says, I'm a queen bee? Why is it 1997 Meredith Brooks was on Top of the Pops singing live and saying, I'm a bitch, I'm a this, but no, there was absolutely no way that...
Like you say, Jacqueline, it goes back to our previous conversation, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's about who has the right, even when there is this disruption of the perception of, you know, spoken power, who then has the right to actually utilise it.
Okay, thank you all for joining me, Shante, Helen and Jacqueline. Keep your thoughts coming in. Charlotte emailed in saying, it's not a nice word. I hate it being used. Not a reclaimed word, a nasty word. Okay, and Rosemary says, listening to your conversation on bitch, for me, it's so wartime. As a child then, I can remember my mother's friends talking about other women as bitches. It's not a compliment. But, you know, it has been... being used in all sorts of different contexts. Your thoughts, please. 84844 is the number to text, or you can email by going to our website. Now the composer Aruj Aftab was born in Saudi Arabia and her family later moved back to her parents' hometown of Lahore, Pakistan. She described her close relatives and their friends as fiendy music lovers. Love that phrase. And her musical influences range from Qawwali and Pakistani semi-classical music to Ella Fitzgerald, Jeff Buckley, and Budgie. At 18, she recorded a jazzy version of Alleluia and then moved to the US to study music, production and engineering. And her latest album, Vulture Prince, includes sounds such as the heavy metal harp and honours and reimagines centuries-old ghazals, a form of South Asian poetry and music that she grew up listening to with a family. And I've been obsessed with this album recently, so I'm absolutely delighted and very grateful that Aruj is up at 5 a.m. from Brooklyn to speak to me. It's not too early, is it, Aruj?
Oh, no, it's just, you know, the usual.
So, you know, that was a kind of a quick potted tour of where you grew up. You grew up in Saudi Arabia and then Pakistan, and it sounds like you listened to a very eclectic mix of music growing up.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I think that the common thread between a lot of the music influences that you listed is probably that they're all quite very melodic oriented, I would say. But yeah, they're definitely all very spread out.
So what happened? You were in Lahore listening to, you know, Jeff Buckley and Qawwalis and with your parents, fiendy music lovers, love that. And then you decided that music was for you, that you had to study it. Did you have to come to America?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that for me, when I decided that studying music was the way that I wanted to go, I realized that there wasn't really, I didn't really have the resources that I needed to do that in Lahore. And in order to really study music in an organized way and earn a degree and study like audio engineering and jazz theory and stuff like that, I'd have to venture outwards. And so that's when I decided that I will inherit a massive student loan and go to Berkeley.
Well, hopefully it'll all pay off. I think we should listen to some music. This is from your latest album, Vulture Prince, and the track is called Bhagome. Let's have a listen. The hairs on my unwaxed arms are standing on end. Simply stunning. Describe the sound for us and the themes here. Because this album was, I've read a bit about it, it's shaped by grief, isn't it?
Yes, partially, but most likely it did take over eventually in the end, in the way that the album kind of feels. These sounds, you know, and the poetry chosen and the way in which I decided to produce the sounds, it kind of has a sense of like disdain for the ways of the world. I think that's kind of the overarching theme throughout the album, and it carries itself in this very graceful, very light on its feet kind of way. You know, especially with the sort of the soft bounciness of the harp and like the very sort of laid back vocal style. You know, there's nothing flashy. There's nothing really like we're not really like showing our chops here. We're just really performing these musics in a way that's like, you know, I'm just kind of tired. You know, the world just keeps turning. And so, you know, it's kind of like, yeah, the theme of it overall of the sound is meant to be kind of like, you know, we're coming out of this sort of feeling of grief, and perhaps one can never really come out of a feeling of grief, but more so just trying to move forward and accept it. So it's more of like an acceptance and hopefulness vibe at the end of the day.
And does it, I mean, I we're playing it on Woman's Hour, and everybody who listens to it can, I'm sure, feel it. You don't need to understand it, but does it matter that people can't understand the language? I know not all the songs are in Urdu, but does it matter?
I've heard that to a lot of people, it doesn't matter because they are feeling the feelings. So for the most part, it seems like musically, the message is coming across.
I've got to ask you about one of your main musical influences, because she's an absolute god in my eyes, and it's the great Abdul Parveen, one of the most revered musicians in South Asian history, a great female Sufi voice, and you met her.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about this.
Well, yeah, I mean, Abdul Parveen is literally, I think, one of the most incredible musicians of our time right now in the world. And I did meet her. She was in New York at the time that I was in New York, when I was just, I had just moved. And I literally stalked her to her hotel room to meet with her. Although, I mean, the story is much longer than that. But yeah, I mean, that was a really pivotal moment for me in my career and in my thought process, especially at such a young point where I wasn't sure exactly what it was that I was going to really do with my sound and with my whole vibe. And so she really, that one encounter was really life-changing.
I'm sure. And it says something about your bravery and confidence as well, and ability to just knock on someone's door and...
You know, we're crazy. When you really have the bug, you really have the bug, right?
Absolutely. So tell me, I know Vulture Prince is out, and if you must discover it, you're going to have the most divine weekend listening to it. But your next album, you're researching a woman called Chand Bibi. Tell me about her.
Mm-hmm. So Chand Bibi was this woman who existed in the Deccan Empire in South Asia, and she basically was royalty. She was a politician, she was a warrior, she was a feminist. And then when the Deccan Empire fell, she was a courtesan, but she continued to be sort of, a political advisor, just this all around, just like this incredible woman at the time. And not a lot of people know about her, or there isn't much written about her. She's also one of the first women, or I believe the first women in the South Asian subcontinent, who wrote an anthology of poems, and her poetry went viral. A lot of that poetry is lost today, but we do have some of it. And I kind of got really interested in her work because it was referred to me by my very good friend Annie Ali Khan.
Do discover her work and create your next stunning album, come back to Woman's Hour and talk to us about it.
Absolutely.
And I'll try not to get you up at 5 a.m. in the morning. Aruj, thank you so much. That is Aruj Aftab. The album is out. It's called Vulture Prince. You can tell I like it. I think we should play out on some of Aruj's music. This is Sans Slow. I've just had a message in from someone saying, great program. Thanks, Sarah. She says, really interesting about language. My partner, male, told me to man up whilst having a contraction, giving birth to our second daughter. Was not impressed. No, neither is anyone else listening to Woman's Hour. Have a wonderful weekend. Emma will be back on Monday. That's all for today's Woman's Hour. Join us again next time.
The System.
A new 6-part thriller from BBC Radio 4.
What do you want to do with your life? Do you want to spend your time glued to a screen, feeding the dopamine addiction you don't even know you've got, looking at pictures of things you'll never have, places you'll never go, and people you'll never meet? Or do you want to exist in the real world? Do you want to be part of something? Do you want to use your body, the only body you'll ever have, gifted to you by millennia of evolution? Do you want to use it for something other than swiping and clicking and tapping and eating donut holes? If so, we may have something for you.
The System.
A new 6-part thriller from BBC Radio 4.
Available now on BBC Sounds.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Collider says BritBox has TV everyone should be watching. Stream acclaimed series with powerful performances from Jodie Whittaker, Tamara Lawrence, Bella Ramsey, and Matthew McFadyen. Discover new BritBox original series you won't find anywhere else. Like Three Little Birds, Agatha Christie's Murder is Easy, and a new chapter of BAFTA-winning drama, Time. Stream what the New York Times calls the best of British telly, only on BritBox. Start a free trial at BritBox.com.